Okay, what I'd like to do is just give a very brief kind of report on research which is in progress. It's a project which is looking at Canadian daily newspaper coverage of issues and events related to international peace and security. And what I'd like to do, just very briefly, is not sort of give you a summary of how I spent my summer vacation. And I can't give you a summary of findings because, as I suggested, it's work which is still in progress, but rather just to convey a sense of some of the thinking that underlies this project. And I just want to say that I'm particularly pleased to be participating in this conference today with Professors Robinson and Gitlin, because their work in different ways has directly informed this project. Well, one starting point is a phrase from a poet whom I heard actually on Vancouver's co-op radio, CFRO, which I think is what, 102.7 on the dial? There are some people here from co-op radio, and I would like to put that plug in for it. I've forgotten the gentleman's name, but he was speaking on a program called The Brown Bagger. And one thing he said definitely struck me, and he said that the real dilemma, or the real tragedy of human existence today in the nuclear age, is not that we're all going to blow ourselves up, but that we acquiesce in it. Now, that's a fairly heavy thought to digest just before dinner, but and I certainly don't accept the fatalism that is implicit in it, but it suggests one starting point for the research which I'm now doing. That is that if we are to survive in a nuclear age, our acquiescence in or resistance to the process of the arms race is crucial. And secondly, the degree to which we acquiesce or resist is in some way related to the agenda setting and reality confirming power of the mass media. Because after all, what we know about international relations, what we know about what threatens us, or what we think we know about what threatens us, and indeed how we define us as a group, as a collectivity, all of these things bear upon how the world is structured in the mass media. So that's one perhaps very important starting point for this research. Another one, perhaps more technically starting point, is that I'm interested in generating data which is relevant to assessing the usefulness of three broad political theoretical perspectives on the media, each of which has different implications for how the media actually cover phenomena like East-West relations or the arms race. And very briefly and crudely put, a pluralist position would see the media as an arena of debate between contending positions. A radical or stratification or elite theory would see the media as reinforcing the ideological hegemony, that is, the modes of thought which legitimize elite or ruling class domination. And there's also, you've probably heard of groups like Accuracy in Media in the United States. There's a growing neoconservative critique of the media as being dominated by a bunch of left liberal journalists who are perhaps refugees from the 1960s. And therefore they're going to be soft in communism or don't understand the need for strong defense and perhaps are naive about the extent and nature of the Soviet threat. So there's those three, and there certainly are many other perspectives that one could take on the political role of the media. But I'm particularly interested in the more or less directly conflicting claims of those three schools of thought. And I'm hoping to generate data that bears upon assessing the relative usefulness of those schools of thought. And a third starting point is an interest in the methodological diversity of the whole field of study of media texts. There is, I suppose, and it's perhaps still dominant, but it has been challenged recently, but there is the approach of quantitative content analysis, of course, which, as many of you will know, some of you as my research assistants, involves devising categories which are assumed to be relevant to your hypothesis, and then basically counting them up in terms of frequency. There's also various forms of qualitative content analysis, and more recently we've seen the emergence, for example, of semiotics, of deconstructive criticism, which is something I tend personally to avoid like the plague, but it's there. And there's also various kinds of linguistic and discursive analysis. And to some extent, I've chosen to try and incorporate that methodological diversity in this project. Okay, so if those are starting points, let me just suggest some criteria about how we might evaluate the media's performance if indeed they are to promote international peace, to promote the prospects for survival in the nuclear age. What should we expect the media to do? What should we expect the media to be like? Now, obviously, I think just to pose the question, it's immediately apparent that that's a highly political question. It's tied to your perspective on East-West relations. If, for example, you accept the motto of peace through strength, or the motto that if you want peace, prepare for war, then probably you would like the media to emphasize the nature and extent of the Soviet threat, to emphasize differences in values and intentions between the Soviet Union and the West, and to help build public awareness and public opinion in such a way that it's favorable towards strong deterrence through military preparedness. That, very crudely put, is one possible perspective leading to particular sets of expectations about how the media ought to perform. Obviously, a very different perspective is given by the disarmament movement, or movements in the plural. And again, simplifying somewhat, perhaps the disarmament movement would expect the following criteria from the media if the media are to be useful in promoting peace. Firstly, the media should avoid exaggerating threats to security in such a way as that it might lead to a kind of siege mentality. It might promote a kind of siege mentality on the part of media audiences, and ultimately legitimize militarist or repressive pseudo-solutions to political problems. Secondly, one might hope from this perspective that the media would not disempower their audiences. That is, that the media should give information which enables readers or viewers to orient themselves in the world and to act in the world in ways other than buying the latest kind of pantyhose or the latest brand of beer. A third criterion might be that the media should avoid unduly dichotomizing the world into us versus them. That is, the media shouldn't inflame we group chauvinism, that we all wear lily white hats and they out there wear the pure black hats. And the media should convey some sense of other countries' perspectives and interests in international relations. Fourthly, one might hope from this perspective that the media should convey a proper sense of proportion about issues, that there should be some correspondence between the media's agenda and what is important for us to know about the world if we are to act effectively in it. So there should be some correspondence between the importance or prominence of issues portrayed in the media and what we need to know in order to act effectively. And fifthly, the media should distinguish between rhetoric on the one hand and underlying interests and motives on the other. And in particular, the media should avoid uncritically amplifying the views of people who have a vested interest in the arms race. Now, one could probably add to that list, but those are some of the questions that were in our minds when we went about constructing this research project. Those are some of the benchmarks or criteria that we're using to evaluate media performance. I want to say then just a bit about what the research has involved, and at this point I'd like, if I may, to publicly acknowledge the contributions of my research assistants, all of whom are students at Simon Fraser University. They are Ingrid Andreas, Amparo Cadavid, Alison Hearn, Miles Ruggles, Jim Sands, and Suzanne Strutt. I want to acknowledge them not only because of their diligence, but also because anyone who's been through doing a quantitative content analysis knows that it starts, you do it by starting out being a, you know, an intelligent and diligent human being and temporarily turn yourself into a trained gorilla. And I think that my research assistants deserve credit for having gone through the process and still remained decent human beings. But basically what we did was break down the research into several different stages, one of which involved interviews with journalists, officials, experts, and advocates regarding the considerations which shape public and media debates on peace and security. So that was one stage. A second stage was the content analysis of 19 Canadian daily newspapers, drawing partly on work from Professor Robinson, regarding, for example, how much the papers across the country differ in the prominence and treatment of peace and security news. A third stage was to look at the Globe and Mail specifically, partly because of its elite status and its status as, at least in its own mind, Canada's national newspaper, and to look at its patterns of coverage of human rights violations around the world, and compare that pattern, those patterns, with other evidence, such as that gathered by Amnesty International, for example. And the question is whether the Globe and Mail, as Canada's national newspaper, follows the apparent pattern of the American media, at least as Professors Chomsky and Herman have suggested, that the American media overemphasize atrocities or human rights violations committed by enemy states, and underemphasize the responsibility of the United States itself for terror and murder in its own client states. And obviously one can make a link there between that kind of pattern of content, if you like, and the underlying discourse of us versus the other, the notion that we wear the white hats and we are threatened by these barbaric and unreasonable outside forces. A fourth stage involved looking at the media framing of the Vancouver Peace Walk, which perhaps some of you have at some point participated in. And here we adopted Professor Gitlin's notion of a media frame as a persistent pattern of cognition, interpretation, and presentation of selection, emphasis, and exclusion by which symbol handlers routinely organize discourse. Now, granted, the Vancouver Peace Walk in Canada in the 1980s is very different from what Professor Gitlin looked at, which was the Students for Democratic Society and the anti-Vietnam War movement in general in the United States in the 1960s. But we still found it a quite useful point of departure and comparison regarding the relationship between mass media and oppositional social movements. Well, not surprisingly, although the work is still in progress, it seems that there are quite important differences between how the media covered SDS in 1965 and how Canadian newspapers cover the annual Peace Walk here in Vancouver. Much less negative, much less denigrative here in Canada for a variety of reasons that one can speculate about. But we are still working with the idea that even though the coverage is less openly hostile or negative, the hypothesis we're exploring is that the Canadian media may, perhaps unwittingly, but nevertheless may be engaging in a different strategy or a different process of ideological containment of the disarmament movement. And fifthly, we took some tools of linguistic and discursive analysis and applied them to specific newspaper articles about superpower relations and about terrorism, and particularly the American air raid on Libya in last April. Critical scholars, critical students of the media, have suggested that there's a number of discourses at work in the media and public discussions of peace and security. These might include, as I suggested, the discourse of us versus the other, and another term which has been employed to characterize aspects of the debate is that of newspeak, which is a pun, of course, on George Orwell's term, newspeak. Newspeak, which is a systematic way of using language which tends to naturalize or to justify or to disguise the production and deployment of nuclear weapons. And then there is, of course, the related Cold War discourse of deterrence. Now, whether the media adopt or inflect or reject these discourses is, I think, an open question. And it's one, as I say, which is which we are still exploring. So unfortunately, I can't give you any kind of nice set of findings that we've come up with, given that it's work in process. But I can perhaps suggest some factors, both, if you like, positive and negative, if one accepts the criteria I outlined earlier, about how the media might be expected to play a role in either promoting or undermining the prospects of international peace. I'm not sure how we're doing for time. 5 minutes? Okay, this is a brief summary which perhaps we can expand upon in the discussion later on. Positive factors, or rather, let's take the negative factors first. First, the news tends to focus on spectacular events and colorful disruption and outlandish behavior rather than the substance of disarmament issues. The media seem to have difficulties covering social processes as distinct from events, and certainly the arms race is an ongoing process. Secondly, there is a pattern of cyclical attention to particular issues. And I guess probably most of you who are attentive news observers have the impression, and I think quite correctly, that coverage of the peace movement and of the issues it is trying to raise has declined in the last couple of years, which doesn't mean to say that the issue's gone away or that it's not important, that it's no longer significant for our survival, but rather that the routines and the news values involved in journalism have led it, in interaction with the movement itself, to pay less attention in the last couple of years. Another negative factor, if you like, is that the disarmament movement seems not to be taken as serious politics because it's not electorally important in terms of, you know, party politics. There isn't a peace party or something like the Green Party in Germany, which carries the ball on that issue. Another factor is that foreign news in Canadian newspapers tends to be heavily reliant upon the American news services, which one can argue tends to be covered through a Cold War perspective. The American news services seem to regard Soviet involvement around the world and or perceived threats to American interests as being especially newsworthy. Now in Canada, we may find that kind of Cold War perspective is somewhat inflected by a certain skepticism towards the United States, which is a sort of ongoing historical strand in our political culture. After all, this country was founded on an explicit rejection of being part of the United States. Other research suggests that coverage of the USSR would be highly stereotypical and highly negative. One study that was done, I think, about 3 years ago looked at 6 months' worth of the Toronto Daily newspapers, all three of them, and found that most stories about the Soviet Union were about the military or about spies. Indeed, the researcher, Barry Zwicker, found that there were more stories on spies than all stories on Soviet sports, art, culture, daily life, the economy, foreign policy, media, science, and travel put together. So in his words, you end up with a kind of dehumanized ideological stereotype, a faceless abstraction of the Soviet Union, which one can argue also permeates popular culture and the entertainment media as well as the news media. Now, I think that there's reasons to believe that situation is changing, and we have more and more television programs, documentaries, for example, which try to portray the Soviet Union as at least a society consisting of human beings. I'm thinking of Peter Ustinov's program, for example, Peter Ustinov's Russia, or the series which is now playing on PBS called Comrades, which looks at the daily lives of ordinary Soviet citizens. Another factor, well, the research, some research suggests, as I've already mentioned, is in the pattern of human rights coverage, a greater attention to violations by enemy states than to violations by American client states. That, again, is I think, an open question. I'm not at all certain that thesis will be borne out in our work, but that remains to be seen. And finally, the notion of empowerment or disempowerment, that the news is about things that we can't affect. The news suggests an endless cycle of irrational violence and death and destruction, leading perhaps, and this is an inference on my part, but one might suspect that it leaves audiences with a feeling of helplessness, feeling of or indifference or avoidance. But that would take a different kind of research to really establish. Finally, though, as I suggest, there are some positive factors. First, that the media desire to protect their markets and maintain credibility with audiences. So if audiences themselves demand more serious and critical and in-depth reporting of foreign news, the media will move towards it. And I think that there are signs of that happening. I think that in the past 5 or 6 years, and perhaps other researchers here can comment on that as well, there is evidence of a growing interest amongst audiences in foreign news and in serious coverage of issues affecting international development and peace, not just bang-bang and the latest coups and earthquakes. Another factor is that, of course, most media, at least in Canada, have a vested interest in not directing economic resources away from consumer spending towards military production, because after all, their lifeblood is on derives from consumer advertising. There is also the fact that individual reporters and news outlets are themselves sympathetic to or concerned about the issue of survival in the nuclear age. Although there is this kind of professional ideology of objectivity, which is very powerful, I think, and which acts as a kind of bulwark against being seen as advocates for a particular cause, nevertheless, it does. One can speculate that it does influence coverage sometimes, that journalists themselves feel that this is an issue which should receive attention. And perhaps the most spectacular example that one can think of that kind of feeling influencing news coverage was the April 10th, 1982 edition of the Toronto Star, in which they basically abandoned, for at least one day, the convention of putting a big event on the front page, and instead put on the headline, "Choose Life Over the Bomb." In other words, it was unusual in two respects. One is that it took a position and simply didn't seemingly merely report an event. And secondly, that it was about an issue and not just an event that occurred that day. But I suggest that that is very much still the exception. And certainly, my impression from the interviews I did with several dozen journalists is that they are very concerned about not being seen as advocates for a particular cause, and that this creates problems for the disarmament movement, which feels it has a message that it wants to get to publics through the media. Just very briefly, a couple more positive factors, at least potentially positive. One is that the competitive pressure for scoops and a certain tradition of watchdog journalism will sometimes bring to light information that perhaps our strategic planners would prefer not to have debated in public. And I think one example would be cruise testing in Canada. It was a leak to the news media, I think perhaps ironically from an American source, if I recall correctly, that led to that the whole question of the cruise testing becoming an issue in Canada. And likewise, the fact that the Strategic Defense Initiative represents a change in strategic thinking by the Pentagon, that was likewise a kind of leak to the media, and the media, I think it was CBC, made that an issue. And just finally then, my last point is that if the peace movement itself were to become large and politically representative and active in the electoral arena and to develop credible spokespeople, existing news values and criteria of objectivity would lead to respectful coverage. Now that's a kind of double-edged sword that we can discuss perhaps later, and Professor Gitlin has analyzed that very well in his own work on the New Left and the media. But I think the final conclusion is that the disarmament groups cannot rely on the media to build a movement for them, looking at those factors overall. Okay, I've run out of time, so I'm going to stop and let's get on to some questions.